This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Police used tear gas and batons on Wednesday to disperse a demonstration by striking workers at Kenya's main international airport.
That's reporter Raya Lombor on the strike that halted flights at Kenya's main international airport today. Details coming up. Also, in spite of the state of emergency declared by Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, protests are continuing. Senegalese President Macky Sall has officially been declared the winner of last month's election. And U.S. President Donald Trump has renewed the targeted economic sanctions against Zimbabwe. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, more than 5,000 members of the Kenya Aviation Workers Union went on strike today, stalling operations at Nairobi's Jomo Kenyatta International Airport. Air travelers were forced to cancel or reschedule their flights as security personnel broke up demonstrations within the airport's facility. Raya Lombor reports from Nairobi.
Police used tear gas and batons on Wednesday to disperse a demonstration by striking workers at Kenya's main international airport. The workers' union, which includes employees from the Kenya Airports Authority and Kenya Airways, went on strike earlier in the day. The union said it is striking because of corruption involving top managers, discrepancies in salaries, and objections to a proposed merger between Kenya Airways, the national carrier, and the Kenya Airports Authority, the body responsible for providing and managing all airports in the country. The merger would allow Kenya Airways to run Jomo Kenyatta International Airport. The Kenya Aviation Workers Union feared the agreement would lead to massive layoffs. Union Secretary General Moses Ndiema addressed the striking workers before being detained briefly by security personnel.
Today, we have commenced a strike action to protest against mismanagement within aviation industry, to protest against open and blatant corruption within aviation industry. We stand here today to demand that those who are looting KQ Airline, those who want to muzzle KAA, we are sending a message that the workers of aviation are fed up with you.
James Masharia, Kenya's Transport Cabinet Secretary, maintained the strike is illegal and called the striking workers criminals, maintaining that the strike was illegal.
When you have a job, nobody has failed to pay your salary. Nobody has given you a threat that your job will be at risk. And yet you go on a strike. You have given assurances that the numbers are going up in terms of employment. And you still go on strike. That is called malice. It is called economic sabotage. It is something which cannot be tolerated. It is criminal activity.
He said any deal between Kenya Airways and the Kenya Airports Authority will result in more jobs.
Our aviation sector will be much stronger. It will need more people. Jomo Kenyatta will become a true hub. That's when they should be discussing what was the impact. If it was negative, then yes, they can say, oh, we are giving notice to go on strike.
For several years, Kenya Airways has dominated various routes in the African market. However, since 2013, the company has lost money, recording billions in shillings of after-tax losses. The Ministry of Labour on Wednesday set up a team to resolve the strike. Meanwhile, the Employment and Labour Relations Court is set to hear the dispute case starting Thursday. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
In spite of the state of emergency declared by Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, protests are continuing, including a general strike yesterday. With Parliament to vote on the state of emergency next Monday, Justice Minister Mohamed Salim said the measure has a negative impact because it restricts public freedoms. The UN Human Rights Commission slammed Khartoum for its crackdown on protesters. Nabil Nigam a political analyst in Cairo, discussed the situation with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
After 3 decades of the regime in Khartoum, they have run out of all options. The economical situation is very bad. Their relation with the regional main player like Saudi Arabia and others is not in a good shape. The only maybe two allies to the regime, maybe Ankara and Doha. So the situation is quite untenable for President Omar al-Bashir. The people came out to the street last December and they will not go back until they get what they are after. What they are after is freedom of speech, respect from the government, basic needs like food, fuel, stability. So the Tuesday strike was almost a complete shutdown all over Sudan. The Sudanese Professionals Association, SPA, which has spearheaded anti-government process in the country, says that the March 5th nationwide strike had been a success and it will continue.
The parliament is discussing the state of emergency, and the Sudanese Minister of Justice, Mohamed Salim, said the measure has a negative impact because it restricts public freedoms. What do you make of such a statement?
The regime is in a very bad shape. The president, Bashir, in his speech, declared the state of emergency. And now you hear the Ministry of Justice talking about restriction of freedom of speech. Which one should we believe, the president or the Minister of Justice? So the political regime at large in Sudan is in deep trouble. I believe very much what the Minister of Justice has came out with is trying to maybe flirt with the Brussels or Washington. Both of those capitals expressed officially their discontent with the what's happening in Sudan.
Human Rights Commission slammed Khartoum for its crackdown on protesters, and the United States State Department said it supports the right of the Sudanese people to gather peacefully to voice their demands for political and economic reform and a more peaceful and inclusive Sudan. Would such criticism change al-Bashir's mind?
Mr. al-Bashir is not willing to take the necessary steps. He doesn't want to listen. And sadly, it is the same story again and again. We have seen it in Tunisia, in Yemen. I'm so sad that history keeps repeating itself so fast in the Middle East. I would have expected Mr. Bashir to, after 30 years, to find a way out. Sudan's main opposition party leader, Imam Sadiq al-Mahdi, called on President Bashir to step down and sit with the opposition to find out a peaceful way out, not only for Bashir, but for Sudan. There is danger surrounding Sudan after Sudan has lost the south. So I am so astonished how Mr. Bashir is not getting it. Step down, man, and save the country.
That was Nabil Nigam, a political analyst in Cairo. He discussed Sudan with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Senegalese President Macky Sall has officially been declared the winner of last month's election. The nation's constitutional court confirmed that Sall won 58% of the vote, a majority that allows the president to avoid a runoff vote. The court's action means that the results can no longer be appealed. Opposition groups disputed the election's results, but none chose to officially challenge the outcome. In a nationwide address yesterday in Dakar, Sall said he would make an effort to unite the nation. Sall's re-election campaign was aided by strong economic growth in the country, which rose to over 6%. That is the highest in Africa. According to official numbers, more than 66% of the 6.7 million registered voters cast ballots. Senegal has been considered one of Africa's most stable democracies, with mainly peaceful elections since it gained independence from France in 1960. Fifteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Entrepreneurs, African innovators, and healthcare professionals are urging African leaders to increase the portion of national budgets dedicated to the health sector to save the lives of 10 million women and children by 2035. Eugene Wimana has details from the Africa Health Agenda International Conference in Kigali.
So, when we put it to use and we turn it on...
This is Naomi Simenta, project coordinator at Balala University of Science and Technology in Uganda. Her university invented a device called the Augmented Infant Resuscitator, which gives simple, intuitive feedback on resuscitation quality for babies born with respiratory problems.
Green lights and red lights. So green lights tell you that you're doing the right of the ventilation.
For the device to be easily commercialized, the university allowed it to be marketed by Philips, the Dutch multinational technology company. Simenta says if government spend more on health care, this device could wear a Uganda brand so more health centers could afford to buy it and prevent more deaths.
The innovative projects come with the affordability bits.
I think they really would love to an innovation like this one. I mean, in their patent names, and it's Uganda. I mean, they really love it. But it would take them some time to actually translate their will into the action, which would put, say, this innovation, say, on a shelf and not actually get out to help people like it should.
The World Health Organization says respiratory problems lead to near 2 million newborn deaths and stillbirths a year, and just over 1 million children each year having lifetime disabilities. Every 30 seconds of delay in establishing effective ventilation at birth increases the risk of death by 16%. Simenta was among the more than 1,000 people gathered in Kigali this week for the 2019 Africa Health Agenda International Conference. The goal is to look for ways to improve health care for Africa's population, which is expected to reach 2.5 billion by 2050. Also attending was Robert Kuganab Lem, a member of Ghana's parliament. He says poor leadership in Africa means healthcare funding often is ignored even when money is available. Part of the problem is centralized control, he says.
It should be possible the money collected at the national level is decentralized to get into the regional levels, who in turn would manage the districts. And so the service providers within a region can easily pick up their money from the region rather than from the national office. It is this bureaucracy which is delaying payment, and when payments are delayed, the quality of services would not be good enough because the service providers need the money to replenish their stock of consumables which are used, yet payment is not immediate, it's not quick. And this is what is hampering achieving universal health coverage.
The WHO says only 6 African countries dedicate at least 15% of their annual budgets to the health sector. In 22 African countries, the WHO says 40% of total health expenditure comes from out-of-pocket payments, and 11 million Africans fall into poverty every year due to high medical costs. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Cameroon says 3 months after creating a commission to reintegrate separatist fighters who agreed to disarm, only 20 rebels have surrendered. Separatists fear the commission may be a trap by the military to arrest and punish them, as Moki Edwin Kenzaka reports from Yaoundé.
Thirty-nine-year-old Julius, who for security reasons gives only his first name, is a motorcycle taxi driver in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, but only since November. That is when he says he escaped from a village in the English-speaking northwest after the military raided his rebel camp. Julius says the military killed 13 of his fellow separatist fighters. He has since given up on violence to fight for an independent English-speaking state within Francophone Cameroon. But Julius refuses to hand himself over to Cameroon's commission
to reintegrate rebel fighters because he does not trust authorities.
What happens on the ground is that if one military man is killed, in vengeance they burn down villages. They have gone to the level of committing such atrocities to turn down now and blame it on the fighters on the ground. How do you imagine that those same fighters will trust that they will lay their arms and walk up to them when they suspect they shoot and kill?
Julius returned from Nigeria in 2017, he says, after studying at a university. He had no intention of becoming a separatist until the military, he claims, torched his house. Cameroon's military denies abuses against civilians in battling the rebels and accuses the separatists of committing atrocities. Rights groups say both the military and separatists are guilty of brutalities in the 3-year conflict, with non-combatants bearing the brunt of the violence. But authorities admit thousands of young Cameroonians have become separatists. In December, Cameroon created the Committee to Reintegrate Boko Haram Terrorists and Rebel Fighters who agreed to disarm. But less than 20 separatists have handed themselves over to Cameroon's 2 reintegration centers. Sixtus Gapsa, manager of the reintegration center in the northwestern town of Bamenda, says rebels who want to disarm have nothing to fear.
Those who want to think negatively think that it's a trap. There's no trap in it. I am giving you the guarantee. The head of state has given us the mandate to give our children opportunities to come meet us so that they can stay in peace, live in peace. We're going to take care of them and reinsert them into society. We're even going to give them means to see how they can start new life in a free and stable society.
Gapsa says the centers offer rebels treatments for injuries, job training, schooling, and resources to resettle them back into mainstream society. But Councillor Dennis Mbarga at the Center for the Peaceful Resolution of Conflicts in Yaoundé says the government needs to create trust. He says asking the separatists to disarm while carrying out military raids sends the wrong signal.
Cette commission devait intervenir après un certain nombre de préalables.
Mbarga says nothing much can be expected from the commission if the government does not change its strategy. He says authorities need to show political will to end the war by carrying out sincere dialogue with the people and rebels because the military solution is failing. The separatists, who claim discrimination against the English-speaking minority in majority French-speaking Cameroon, have been fighting for an independent state since 2016. The government says more than 1,200 people have been killed in the fighting, but has dismissed the thought of giving up any sovereignty. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
U.S. President Donald Trump has renewed the targeted economic sanctions against Zimbabwe that have been in place since 2003. Trump stated Monday that the actions and policies of these persons continue to pose an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. foreign policy. To find out more about why the sanctions were first put in place and why they persist, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Bruce Wharton, who served as U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe from 2012 to 2015.
The American sanctions on a limited number of Zimbabweans and Zimbabwean entities was first imposed in direct response to what the U.S. government saw as deliberate destruction of Zimbabwean democratic and economic norms in ways that the U.S. government believed hurt private citizens as well as broad U.S. interests in southern Africa. The sanctions were intended to pressure the people who were ruling Zimbabwe into conducting some reforms, and also to ensure that the people who were benefiting from these distortions of democratic and economic principles weren't easily able to profit, at least in the United States, from those.
I understand why economic and democratic reforms are in Zimbabwe's interest, but why does the U.S. believe that economic sanctions against the country are in America's interest?
On the most simple level, American businesses and American property owners were disadvantaged by Robert Mugabe's land reform program, which we saw as an unregulated, chaotic, and extra-legal process to seize land. We always agreed that land reform was necessary, but the way it was conducted was extremely destructive of the Zimbabwean economy. That, in turn, created pretty significant food shortages in 2002 and 2003 that then required the United States and other donors to come in with several hundreds of millions of dollars worth of emergency food assistance. So those are two very concrete ways in which the actions taken by Zimbabwe's rulers affected the United States. More broadly, though, the destruction of the rule of law, dismissal of the Supreme Court, the government willfully ignoring court orders, threatened the rule of law, not just in Zimbabwe, but set a bad example. And that had long-term implications for American interests throughout the region.
Of course, Mugabe is no longer in power.
I'm afraid the coup of November 2017 was simply a reshuffling of some of the top members of the government, but the structures and the underlying philosophies of government have remained the same.
President Trump extended the sanctions, even though South Africa President Cyril Ramaphosa wanted them lifted. As a former ambassador to Zimbabwe, what do you think would be the best way forward?
You know, I no longer work for the U.S. government, but if I had a free rein, I would do two main things. I am not ready to advocate the complete lifting of sanctions, but I would like to see sanctions made much, much more targeted. There are about 141 people and entities on the sanctions list. That should be reduced to about 24. I think that would make sanctions more effective.
And what about the effects of these sanctions on everyday Zimbabweans?
I am not unaware of the collateral effect of U.S. sanctions. However, I think they are tiny, tiny, tiny compared to the self-imposed sanctions that Zimbabwean government policies have wrought on the people of Zimbabwe. With the continual theft of bank accounts, with the continued extra-legal seizure of land, with policies that really dissuade investors from looking seriously at Zimbabwe, those are the main sanctions that have brought Zimbabwe's economy down.
And what's the second thing you would do if you had free rein to do it?
The second thing I would do would be to set up programs that actively encouraged Americans and American companies to invest in Zimbabwe. I see great opportunities in agriculture, in housing, in the information economy, and in mining. But that, in turn, of course, would require some significant changes in Zimbabwean economic policy.
Bruce Wharton was U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe from 2012 to 2015. He spoke by phone to VOA's Adam Phillips from Asheville, North Carolina. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up. On behalf of our producers, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we are celebrating the accomplishments of women on the continent. This year's United Nations theme is Think Equal, Build Smart, Innovate for Change. An in-depth discussion on the path to gender equality on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis?
We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.